On the show today, the show's taken about a 4 to 5 month hiatus since the turn of the new year, and this is the first time we're doing a recording here since late December, when we had from Bleacher Report MLB's page Zach Reimer on to talk about the upcoming season and also the latest Star Wars that had just come out. So it feels good to be back. It feels good to be on the show here and on the recording. So I reached out to a good friend of mine, someone that knows the Pittsburgh scene, and as of last night, a local celebrity, fresh off his appearance on the WPXI Final Word, Matt Gaccio. Christ, I cannot say your last name as always. But Matt, good to have you on. The lead writer of DK on Sports, a person that's everywhere. And also, true or false, whenever you go to a local Atrias, you get whatever table you want, Goodfellas style.
It's pretty close, and thanks, TJ, for having me. Atrias is great. Their pot roast nachos, I think, are my favorite. So I'll throw that one up there for any people who are wondering what's on the menu. I think that is the first thing that I would get, and it's just an appetizer. So there's plenty more to have after that.
I mean, pot roast nachos, that sounds like that could fill you up pretty well.
Yeah, it could. We had it after I went to a game as a fan, believe it or not, a Pirates game against the Tigers when my sister-in-law and brother-in-law were in from Michigan. So we went to the Atrias right there at PNC Park, very convenient for someone like me who's down there a lot. And, yeah, had a few libations and kicked back, had some nachos, and enjoyed the afternoon.
Nice little plug for them, and nice little segue into your work with DK on Sports. It seems like you're with the Pirates as their beat writer. You're traveling all over the place by following yourself on Twitter, but you kind of do some stuff with the Pittsburgh Riverhounds. So what exactly is your role with DK, and you're going on, what, over a year now with working with him?
Yeah, it's been over a year, and you mentioned the Riverhounds. That was how I got hooked up with Dejan Kovacevic, who is my boss, and he's the DK in DKPittsburghSports.com. He wanted someone to cover Riverhounds games, which is the local pro soccer team. It's in the United Soccer League, which is, you could argue, the second-tier league in the country, along with the North American Soccer League. So it's a level down from MLS, but I really enjoy the sport, first of all, and I started doing their YouTube broadcasts. Mm. They don't do radio in that league. They do everything's on YouTube live. So that's always good. You can go back and catch the games later if you can't watch them when they're going on. But that's how I turned out to be at all the Hounds games, and I started writing about them for DK, and then eventually he must have liked what he saw because he added the Pirates and some college editorial work to my plate, and eventually offered me the full-time gig where I primarily cover the Pirates, although I did do a good bit of Steelers in the fall when we were still looking for our full-time guy. It ended up being Jason Mackey, who came over from the Tribune Review, a newspaper in town, and I covered Penguins practices throughout the winter and spring to spell Josh Yoey, who many Pittsburgh fans know from his work with the Trib and now with our site. So I feel like I get a full palette. I get, again, to use the dinner analogy, a smorgasbord of Pittsburgh sports, even though my primary job is baseball.
So the only thing you're not covering is the Pittsburgh Power, basically.
May they rest in peace.
May they rest in peace. As a former arena football employee down here with the Austin Wranglers, I've seen my fair share of teams come and go, and someone that would work in marketing and sales and be the mascot, which you have not worked in sports until you don a Denver Broncos style mascot costume in the Texas heat at a mini golf putt-putt event at about 3 in the afternoon with your buddy drinking water and going, oh, you can't drink this because you're in a horse costume. So be glad you don't have to do that side of the sports.
Well, you know, that just says how bad you want it, right? And I did. Yeah. I've been a mascot. I worked for a minor league baseball team in Charleston, West Virginia, and part of the intern duties were putting on the mascot costume. And we had 5 different mascots, believe it or not. So wow. I picked the one that was the most comfortable, at least, and went with it. Went to a department store and was outside a few times. It gets hot in Charleston, West Virginia in the summer as well, about 90 degrees most days in July and August. So I feel your pain there, yeah. TJ.
Well, have you ever been reprimanded in your mascot costume by someone who either ran the event or game ops Because that happened to me, dressed as Oliver Onion in the tunnel at PNC Park because we did not do the correct script for the pierogi race.
Wait, you're saying those races are scripted? You just ruined my life.
And, you know, spoiler alert, like professional wrestling, which I do love, sometimes they are. But this one, we kind of went off the script as it was our last day working the inside sales rep office before we were let go for the season because this was the year of the All-Star Game when the Pirates were still a 100-loss team. So we decided to have some fun and break out into a mini dance party halfway through the race, which we then were escorted on the tunnel like normal after it got done. And we didn't delay the game. There was no extra long pitching change or extra long in-between inning break. So it was the four of us in the costumes being yelled at while still in costume, as I said, under the tunnel by whomever the game ops guy was, who's about 5'7", 5'8". So I can only imagine what it looked like as a third-party person walking up on that conversation as this average to small-looking man is yelling at four pierogies.
That's intense stuff, man. That's like General Patton rallying.
Right. And we laughed about it, but on the way back up, we're thinking, did we just lose our jobs for the next coming spring? Which it didn't really matter because that following year I moved to Austin anyways. But still, it was my one way of how I almost got completely blackballed out of sports by almost throwing a pierogi race.
You've done it all, my friend. I think you could say that.
I think so. Even now hosting a podcast that's listened by hundreds of people. Not thousands, just hundreds. Maybe 10. I'm not really sure. I think my people at Place to Be Nation to figure out what our metrics are. But okay, so we'll get back into DK on sports and for what you guys do. So you, as you announced on your social media platforms, are an expecting father. First one that you know of, I'm assuming. By the way, don't use that joke with your wife at doctor's appointments. They really hate you saying, this is the first child that I'm aware of. When the doctor asks, this is the first one that you and your wife have. But how did you get away with spending the entire spring training down in Florida with the team while your wife was expecting?
Well, we found out when I was down there, so wow, it wasn't as bad as it sounds. And just biting the bullet in this first year, we're still a really small staff at DK Pittsburgh Sports, so I figured that it was going to be me for the long haul, and it really was when I was down there. 44 days was my total stay, and I really only had maybe 5 or 6 days off. DK, my boss, came down and wrote a few columns and coverage pieces in the middle of March, but it was complete immersion. I was there as much as anybody. I'd like to say outside of the players and coaches and Pirates staff, I was the one there the most, so I take some sort of perverted pride in that. Right. It was good, especially for someone like me in his first year. It is it's instructive to just be there day in, day out, and appreciate the grind. People talk about the 162, as in the regular season, 162 games, but there are 30 spring training games and 10 full workouts or whereabouts before that, and there's really nothing at stake, especially on a team like the Pirates, where so many of their starting positions are already solidified. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know it's a bad team when there's a lot up for grabs and there's a lot at stake in the springtime. Right. So if you're a good team, it's not going to be the most dramatic spring. It's going to be the battle for the last couple of spots on the bench. And so you have to get creative. You have to write mostly features. And honestly, I enjoyed that. I thought it was fun. I think the players and the coaches and even the manager to an extent and the general manager are all more relaxed. As spring, there's less on the line. So I think they feel more open. They're not as stressed out as opposed to now midseason. We're in June now, so it's more than a third in. And you get guys being more reserved, more businesslike, leaving really quickly after games because they spend enough time at the ballpark, and I get that too. So it was a really valuable time for me to get to know the team and to get to know the players and the personalities.
So myself included, as a fan of the Pirates, on social media, we clamor for Glasnow and Talion. Was there any inclination during the spring that they had a snowball's chance in hell to make that main roster when opening day started? Or, was there anybody that you saw that you thought, why is this person not on the main roster over someone that is a bench player, but really isn't doing too much for, the roster?
The only guy that I thought could have made it and didn't make it was Jason Rogers, the corner infield guy who's now at AAA. But I understood and I appreciated the appeal of Cole Figueroa, who is with the team now. He bounced down to Indy for a couple of weeks, but was recalled. The Pirates like defensive positional flexibility, and Clint Hurdle loves to play the double switch game. He enjoys National League Baseball. He likes the manager's role in that type of a game. And I can see why. It's, number one, it's probably fun. It's more fun than being in the AL and sitting there and maybe occasionally calling for a pinch hitter and going out and removing your pitcher, but that's about it. In the National League, you're more engaged, and it keeps the players on the bench more engaged, too. And when you have some quality guys like David Freese, like Sean Rodriguez having a nice bounce-back offensive season, Matt Joyce, what a terrific year off the bench so far in the hitting category. So all those things come into play when you look at how a team constructs its roster. But to answer your question, from the pitching standpoint, you mentioned Glasnow and Taillon. I didn't think there was a great chance at all. Maybe not a 0% chance, but once I saw Glasnow pitch for the first time, this is a long, lean guy who I think has a tendency to get out of whack. I don't think, I know. I've seen it with my own eyes in person, and it didn't take me long to look over to Taillon and say, well, the hype is all about Glasnow because he had two really amazing years in the minors, or three, to rise to top prospect status in the game. But people forget about Taillon. He was chosen second overall in 2010 for a reason, and even though he had 2 years away from competition, I think he used that time to refine, and he also has a maturity about him. He's older than Glasnow, too, so that helps as well, but he's been through a lot. And if there was one guy, one pitcher who I thought could surprise, it was going to be Taillon, but I get why the Pirates wanted to see him pitch in games that meant something at the AAA level, because he hadn't done that since 2013. So I would like to say that I'm shocked by how well he's done, but I'm really not, based on what I saw in spring, and I fully believe he'll be in the big leagues in 10 days' time. I think one more turn through the rotation and the Pirates will feel good about getting past that Super 2 point.
Right. I think I saw you tweet this out the other day, maybe yesterday. Huntington had his press conference, and didn't he say he wanted to see Taillon pitch June 4th, I think it was, in Indianapolis, so the earliest he could be up is June 11th?
Somewhere around there, yeah. I think, well, I know that Huntington said that he wants to get one more start, and that was his weekly radio interview. He's down in Bradenton preparing for the draft, which starts on Thursday. We didn't get a chance to talk to him, so I just gleaned some nuggets from Greg Brown, the Pirates broadcaster, talking to him on 93.7 The Fan yesterday. But Greg asked about one more minor league start at least for Taillon, and Huntington confirmed that. So the earliest he could start is next week at the Mets. And I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know if the Pirates want to throw him into the fire going up against, I don't know if there's a probable announce yet, but it could very easily, if you look at the rotation, it could be Noah Syndergaard. I don't know if you want to throw your guy out there in that spot against someone who has taken the league by storm since he came up right around this time last year. So if you're looking for a softer landing spot, and again, this is the big league, it's never going to be easy, but two more turns through the rotation, and it's home against the Giants, which coincidentally is the same team that Garrett Cole made his debut against at PNC Park 3 years ago. So I'm kind of torn between whether they're going to bring him up for that Mets series, or maybe they bump him a couple days back in the rotation. Maybe he pitches at Wrigley Field. That's a tough place. So again, that first home series after this current homestand, when they go on the road coming up next week, that one is looking really appealing to me, and something that I might be circling mentally on my calendar.
You know, whenever I was thinking of stuff to talk about on this recording today, I knew it was Pittsburgh heavy, whatnot. Neil Walker, he was moved in the offseason for John Neese. Neese has been, you know, hit or miss, it seems like, throughout the entire season, whereas Neil Walker has really flourished for the Mets. Seeing how this offense is working on the Pirates, do they really miss Walker, or is this a thing where, you know, the trade didn't really affect them that much?
It's a complicated equation. I'm going to write on this for my Matt Stats piece on Thursday on the site, so a good way to tease it right now.
Right.
I was trying to think about how I would analyze who has, quote-unquote, won the trade so far through a third of the season. And you look at Walker's numbers, even with a recent fall off from that ridiculous pace he was on, especially power-wise, he's still better than Josh Harris, and he's still one of the better hitting infielders in baseball. So in that sense, yes, the Pirates do miss him. Who couldn't put to use double-digit home runs at this part of the year? The Pirates don't have a guy yet who has reached 10, and I don't think Walker's going to hit 40 like he's on pace to do, but I think he has a really good shot at 25, which would be a really nice output for a middle infielder. So from that standpoint, they miss him. Also, though, you have to take into consideration defense. I thought this was going to be more of a clear victory for Josh Harrison, but while he's getting to more ground balls than Neil Walker ever did, he's also bobbling quite a few, and he hasn't paid for it in the error department every time. He's quick enough to make up for it. He is a master of improv in a lot of ways, so he is pretty well positioned out of a lot of the Pirates to make something from nothing, and if he makes a mistake, he can recover. But the hands worry me a little bit for Josh Harrison. He hasn't been as smooth on the turn at the double play spot at the pivot either. I'm not sure I expected him to be as good as Walker was, but that's something else to consider. And of course, then there's the guy who was traded for Neil Walker, John Neist, and really an awful start. Every ball he gave up, every ball in play, I should say, he gave up was in the air early on this season, and that's not why the Pirates acquired him. They got him because he was a really good ground ball guy. But those numbers have evened out. He's back over 50% in inducing grounders, and he's given up quite a bit of homers. He explains part of that because he's had leads in games, and he's being aggressive, and when you're aggressive and you miss over the plate, home runs happen, especially in some of the ballparks he's pitched in. But that sounds like more of an excuse than a legit explanation. So I think command could be better for him, even though his stuff appears to be rounding into form. So I think the Mets have gotten the better of this deal so far, if I just had to eyeball it. And we'll see what the numbers turn out this week as I dig into it.
Could Neese also be aggressive? Because as millennials would put it, the Pirates bullpen equals poop emoji.
Yeah, that might be part of it too. I think he's trying to get quick outs. All the Pirates pitchers are, and to varying degrees of success. You've seen Jeff Locke do really well with that recently, and I give him so much credit for reinventing himself on the fly, throwing a different breaking pitch, being more convicted with his pitch execution, and that sounds really wonky, but what it means is committing to the pitch and throwing it and not worrying about being too fine. And Ray Searage has told me that on multiple occasions. That's what he is pounding into these guys' heads, whether it's Jeff Locke or Francisco Liriano, who's going through some terrible struggles at the moment. But, John Neese, he's got to be aggressive. He's not going to get guys to swing and miss, so it would be foolish to run up these high pitch counts and try to get deep into counts early on, because he's always going to be a guy who does better when he's getting outs on three pitches or less, when he's getting soft contact early in the count, when he's getting guys off balance, when they're looking for one pitch and he gives them another, or he puts it in a tough spot. That's the way he's going to succeed. It's not going to be trying to strike out guys with stuff that is rather average for a major league pitcher. So you're not going to get, even in this era of enhanced strikeouts for hitters and pitchers, you're not going to get that many Ks when you have his type of stuff. So he and Jeff Locke are very similar in that way, both lefties, and Locke's throwing a bit harder than Neese is this year, but they're attacking, and sometimes that goes against you when balls drop in or balls sail over the fence. But for right now, for both of them, they're on a nice little run, and that's helped stabilize them.
And I think, as some Pirate fans would attest to this, Jeff Locke being on a run is great because you want the team to win, but terrible because you want to send him away in a hot air balloon like in the movie Up. Am I right on that one?
Yeah, it's such a dichotomy with Jeff Locke, because I think it was assumed at some point that he was going to be pushed out of the rotation, and he still might by a younger guy this year.
Right.
But from what I've seen so far, Juan Nicasio is the biggest candidate to be sent to the bullpen. I think he would be spectacular in a two- or three-inning role, someone who comes in the fifth or the sixth or even the fourth when the starter isn't doing well, because you look at most of his starts this year, he blows guys away in the first inning. Hard fastball, good slider, but he doesn't have that third pitch. The changeup isn't a pitch you can really respect at this moment. It's more of a novelty. So, and we've known this since spring, but I think the Pirates were hoping you'd give him a little bit more than he has in terms of results. So I think he'll be the first one sent down because it's a great fit for him in the bullpen. He could really bolster that whenever I think it'll be Jameson Taillon replacing him in the rotation, but we shall see about that. But if you're going to look at a number two guy to be knocked out of the rotation, then I think it still has to be Locke, because the Pirates aren't paying John Neese $9 million to be a relief pitcher. And I hate to put it in those stark of terms. I don't think it's necessarily that easy of a decision or that clean cut just because of salary. Because in the end, if you pay John Neese $9 million and Jeff Locke, $3 or $4 million, and one of them's a starter, one of them's a long reliever, it's still, you're paying out $13 million total. But I think there is some of that, and I think they want to give Neese an opportunity in his first year as a Pirate to see if they want to bring him back, because he has those option years in his contract, and it's important for them to figure out if he's a fit for the team going into 2017 and 2018.
So I always have this, before I get into this next question about the Pirates here, this one real quick, because it's been pinging in my head for a couple minutes here, because we talk about Jeff Locke. Is Jeff Locke this generation's Pirates fans Josh Fogg?
Now, Josh Fogg had a decent run with the Rockies after he left Pittsburgh.
Oh, I forget about that. I black out after, him constantly going 10-11 with a 3 ERA.
Yeah, he was not playing on the best Pirates team in the world when he was in town. But I think Jeff Locke probably has a little bit better stuff than Josh Fogg. Mm. Fogg was your ultimate pitch-to-contact guy. From what I remember, a sinker was his best pitch, sinking fastball, and it was all about the grounders. We've seen Locke at times look downright deceptive. I'm not sure Josh Fogg ever deceived anybody. I think he was coming at you, and that's what you were getting. Whereas, especially Locke this year, you're seeing more off-balance swings. You're seeing guys look crossed up because he's thrown the changeup a lot more. As I mentioned, the breaking pitch is tighter and faster. And he's throwing harder, too. He had that revamp of his delivery in the spring, and it appears to be paying off with enhanced velocity. He's just tightened everything up, and there aren't as many energy leaks in that delivery, if you will. So he's transferring more to the baseball, and that's working out too. You may scoff and say, well, what's the difference? He throws 93 now as opposed to 91, but right, every millisecond you can take away from the hitter when it comes to identifying pitches is crucial in winning that battle. So, yeah, I wouldn't put him in quite that Josh Fogg category, although there was an interesting story that Clint Hurdle told. Clint managed Josh Fogg in Colorado, and he started that game 163 that we all remember against the Rockies in 07. I'm sorry, against the Padres at Sports Field in 07, and went extra innings and all of that. But it seemed like, Clint joked, that they called him the Dragon Slayer, because you go up against all these aces. It was against Jake Beebe in that winner-take-all game, and Fogg battled him to a draw, essentially, and the Rockies won it in extra innings. So Josh Fogg had his moments in the sun with that 07 Rockies team that went all the way to the series.
I guarantee this is the only time Josh Fogg's been talked about in this length in probably the last 10 years.
Maybe.
Probably. So, did I miss this incorrectly on Saturday when when Jeff Locke pitched? But is he looking a little more like Jack White with his hair and his mustache?
I can see that.
Okay.
I've been told I look like him, but
it's
got to
be the hair. It's got to be the hair. It's the only reason why.
It's just, people see the hair, and I guess it's a little bit uncommon. But I can see the Jack White thing a little bit. I think Jeff is thicker than Jack White, so if you lost about 20, 30 pounds, it might be a pretty ringing endorsement or a similarity there.
Well, I would say just Google Kurt and Jeff Locke and then Jack White, angry Chicago Cubs fan, and I think you'll be able to see the similarities.
I love that photo of Jack White.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we're coming up here on the half hour here and get you out. So you can go off and do one of your 16 things for DK as he's chained up in his basement, because, as all bloggers are, we're all basement people.
I don't work in my basement. I work in the rec room.
So. Oh, there you go. Even better. As long as there's a TV there and a window, you're a step above person who has a Tumblr account. So real quick, trades. Pirates, this offseason, they're going to come up. on the deadline on the 31st or whenever it is this year. What's the chances some of the big prospects get moved, like an Austin Meadows, Reese McGuire, because they just signed Cervelli to a long-term deal, plus they have Stewart for a couple more years, or moving someone like Italian at the deadline as well?
I think Reese McGuire's stock is a little bit down. He hasn't handled double-A pitching very well, but then again, I'm talking about as a hitter. He's always been good as a receiver behind the plate as the Pirates' catching prospect. You raise a good point about Cervelli, so I start to wonder, but that contract is still going to run out, and you're going to need somebody at a very important position. And so Reese is young for double-A, so I'll give him a pass for his results so far this year. I think it's more likely we see, like you're mentioning, Austin Meadows, who's an outfield prospect for the Pirates, and a really good one. He could be a big trade piece. I keep looking at Josh Bell, and I'm wondering, where does he fit with this team long-term? And I know that first base is where they have him right now, but I feel like he'd be more valuable as an outfielder. And I saw him move around in spring training, play several Grapefruit League games, and the guy can move. It feels like his athleticism, to me, is wasted at first base. So I'm sure there are plenty of teams out there who are saying, look at Josh Bell hitting a triple A. We could plug him into a corner outfield position, and he could be our number three hitter or number five hitter or number six somewhere in the middle of the lineup for many, many years to come. So there's an option. But if you look at the track record of Neil Huntington, he's never really dealt one of the big guys, one of the top rated prospects in his system. So I would be really surprised if he does. He's traded from depth. He used Dilson Herrera to get Marlon Byrd a few years back from the Mets in 2013. He was about the 10th rated prospect in the Pirates system. He traded Jacoby Jones to the Tigers. Not that Jacoby Jones, but the other one. Not the one who returned kicks for the Steelers, past tense.
Right.
But the infielder, and got Joaquin Soria at the deadline last year from Detroit. So those are more the types of players that Huntington likes to move, not necessarily the ones who have the huge upside. And I get that with the way the Pirates operate. You and I could argue on whether they want to spend more money, whether they could spend more money. I'm sure they want to, but whether they could or whether they will, I'm not sure. I think they're going to stick to this slow and steady increase at the major league level. So to answer your question, I don't really think we're going to see a big move in terms of a Tyler Glasnow, certainly not, or Jameson Taillon, or Josh Bell, Austin Meadows. I think those four guys, throw in Reese McGuire, I'd say those five, top five right now in the minor league system, I think they all will be Pirates at the end of the year.
So I can stop my fan fiction of emptying out the farm system for Justin Verlander idea.
Verlander's had a nice little comeback, but I'm not sure I'd pick up that contract.
Oh, sure. Well, you make Illich in Detroit pay. I mean, he's almost dead. So, someone comes in, fills in the numbers for him, he signs off on it because he wants to win now, but yet build to the future. Or maybe they'll empty out for him and Cabrera. Why not? Just throw them all in. But give them both. We'll fix the first base need and also the starting pitching as well. Done.
Well, you have me sold on the Cabrera thing, even though he's an older guy, but I think he'll be productive for many, many years.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So, actually, that just made me think of the Angels, but the Angels don't have any starting pitching, and they're getting long in the tooth, and really I don't see them going anywhere. But I don't think there's anybody out there right now that I can think of that's worth emptying out a farm system for. But I could be wrong. Come July, we might see what's going on. But the other reason why I had the trade idea in my head is the Penguins. We'll touch on them here as they play in Stanley Cup Final Game 4 tonight as we record on Monday. MAF, Marc-Andre Fleury, probably played his last game in Game 5 in the Eastern Conference Finals. I still could see them keeping him maybe as a backup role for Murray coming into the season next year, or letting MAF play in the regular season, because he's averaged at least 35 wins each year he's played in a full season, I think, except for his first year. But follow me down the rabbit hole on this idea. Fleury and Pouliot, because I heard that they're looking to ship him because there's no room on defense for Derek, to Edmonton for a Taylor Hall. Maybe, I think, Yakupov, if they can get him under a year. And they're number one for Edmonton. Who says no to that?
Oh, I think the Oilers might say no because...
Really?
Yeah, I think if you're a smart manager right now, I wouldn't overpay or I wouldn't pay for someone else's goaltending. I'd try to develop it myself. I'd try to find someone who's less than established and pay them less. Because if you look at recent history, you don't need a highly paid goaltender to win. And if you have a good enough team, you can insulate that goaltender. And I know that goes counter to playoff orthodoxy in the NHL, but more often than not, it's the great team that wins. It's the Chicago Blackhawks. It's the Los Angeles Kings. Very rarely is it your 2011 Bruins, where Tim Thomas is unbelievable for an entire season,
right,
playoffs included, and maybe covers up some flaws. Or Cam Ward gets unbelievably hot. Looking back 10 years ago now, it's hard to believe it's been that long, but that's when the Canes won the Cup. So, for me, the average final team, the average championship team in the NHL is winning with slightly above average goaltending to good goaltending, but having just a really complete team. So, you throw in Pouliot, it's intriguing if I'm the Oilers, but then I think, is he going to turn out like Justin Schultz turned out in Edmonton? And Justin Schultz has been a really good player for the Penguins, but on a team without much in terms of older leadership, without much in terms of stability, maybe it doesn't work out. But on the other side, Pouliot would get a chance to play, and he gets an opportunity to show his stuff, whereas in Pittsburgh, I get the sense he's looking over his shoulder every time he gets in the lineup.
No kidding.
That might free him up. But it is, I think, the only real hole in this Penguins team right now is a game-breaking winger. They don't have that at the moment. And I know Phil Kessel, I put him in a different category, but I'm talking about a guy who can dangle around you, who can make plays, who can do it all. And I know that's tough to get when you're paying your centers essentially max contracts. I don't know if you can fit that all into the cap. You have a Chris Letang as well on the blue line. But if you look at a team like the Sharks, and they have someone like Tomas Hertl, and boy, would he be a nice fit for any team, but especially the Penguins. Someone to play off of Crosby and Malkin, because it doesn't appear that, well, I don't want to say that, because Phil Kessel had a few games with Crosby, he had a few games with Malkin, and he looked pretty good before Malkin got hurt. So maybe Phil could fit long-term with one of them, but you're not getting the most out of your stars right now when you have Malkin flanked by Rust and an aged Chris Kunitz, or you have a good player, but a limited player, Patrick Hornqvist, and a young guy in Connor Sheary, who kind of comes and goes in terms of his play during these games. So, and they're on Crosby's wings. There's just that one spot where, and maybe it's Phil Kessel moving forward, but I'd love to have someone else to ride shotgun with one of the big star centers.
What if I throw in Malkin for the deal, but Evans got to give back McDavid, and they throw away the number one pick?
Wait, so you throw in Malkin, and who do the Penguins get back?
Connor McDavid.
Okay, wow, now you're really talking, I guess. Well, that would be a center for center. So,
and you get younger Crosby.
Situation.
Younger, cheaper Crosby.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if the Oilers feel like they're at the spot where they want to, I guess, bring in someone who's in the middle of their career. Maybe they want to watch this group grow up. And I think there's a lot of psychic investment in Connor McDavid at this point. He is the man. So that would be a complete abrupt change of direction for Peter Chiarelli up there in Edmonton. I would have a hard time doing that, because even though you and I can sit back and say that would technically make them better, maybe, I'm not even sure I'd say that, because McDavid's best years are ahead of him.
That's very true.
And I don't think you can say the same thing about Malkin, but you're trying to build something, and you sell that to your players, and it's tough to sell that when you make a huge move like the one you're proposing and blow it all up.
That's why these are wacky trades. These are why they're throwing stuff. This is like you're cooking the spaghetti and you're throwing it against the wall. You're seeing what sticks. But honestly, though,
yeah, no doubt.
With Fleury, is it feasible to think that, I know you said a big goaltender doesn't carry you to a deep playoff run, which I do agree. I just wanted to say flatly, I do agree, as even though Chicago, Corey Crawford carried them to two Stanley Cups, and I think he's average at best. But Jonathan Quick,
well, I don't think he didn't carry them either.
No,
he was fine.
He back-ended two Stanley Cup runs with the Blackhawks. But If you're Dallas or St. Louis, do you not at least give a call into Pittsburgh and see what it would take to get Fleury off the team?
Dallas is a really, really prime candidate for someone to take advantage of this offseason. I think Jim Knoll is a smart GM, but he's in a desperate spot. He just paid upwards of $10 million this year for two goalies, and neither one of them was really
right.
That great. I still think Kari Lehtinen is a good keeper, so I might keep him around. And there's another one of those Stanley Cup goalies who you might consider average, is Antti Niemi, in that side of the Dallas tandem. Yeah, them and St. Louis, two teams that, maybe Dallas a little bit closer, I would argue, to being the best team in the West. But, of course, St. Louis made it further this season, so and they've been knocking on the door for many, many years. I think you have to shop around if you're Jim Rutherford, see what you can get. I don't think Matt Murray is anywhere near a finished product. I look at some of the goals he's allowed this playoff, and he looks like a rookie in there. But then other times, he makes the game-changing save, too, and you need a few of those. But I look at him right now, and I see a guy that I wouldn't be comfortable handing the keys to for, say, more than half the games next year. I think we're still going to see a tandem in Pittsburgh. Mm. I still think Fleury will play more games than Murray next year, assuming status quo. And I think that's a good assumption, because you go into the next offseason, next summer, with a likely expansion draft, and then you know a lot more about Murray and Fleury as well, how he's going to bounce back from what has assuredly been a very frustrating springtime for him.
And, I mean, it is unfair to him to expect him to come into Game 5, a pivotal Game 5 against Tampa, and be the Fleury that carried this team in 2008 and 9, and hell, even 2010, whenever they lost to the Canadiens in the second round of that year. One last trade for Fleury, potential partner. What if Buffalo calls you up and says, Fleury for Evander Kane? What do you think?
Oh, there's that winger again that I'm talking
about, right?
Someone who could help the centers out. I would have to think about it, really, if I were the Penguins. I think, well, then you have the Dan Bylsma factor. Maybe he feels some comfort with Marc-Andre.
That's why I brought Buffalo. And,
yeah, right. That one makes some sense, for sure, for both sides. If you're asking who says no first, I think it's still Buffalo, because I bet they think they can get by without top-level goaltending. They're still building. I know that they like what they have in Kane as far as his potential, and they're still in that wait-and-see mode. They're still in that tryout mode in a lot of ways, and they might be closer to the playoffs next year. I'm sure they hope they are going to be, but it's still a couple of years away before we can talk about them being a contender for the division, or a contender to win the Eastern Conference.
Mm-hmm.
So adding a 31, 32-year-old goalie doesn't quite fit with that parameter.
Gotcha. Well, I'm sure any way, shape, or form, if something does happen this summer, Penguins Twitter will react rationally, calmly, and not overreact whatsoever one way or the other. I'm right on that, correct?
Yeah, you know, my bugaboo this playoff is people telling other people not to panic. Well, people are going to panic if they want to panic. Just let them be fans, you know?
Right.
I just like to sit back and watch it. So it's a good spectator sport.
Just like I'm sure you like to sit back and watch whenever you write something you're very proud of, you did a lot of work in it, and someone goes right down the comment section and just comments on the headline and reads nothing about it.
Yeah, believe it or not, it does still happen on our site. Not as much as it would happen if we were a free site. I think people paying for
it gives them
more of a sense of investment in the community. So that has been an unexpected positive for me writing for this site, is that it's a more constructive type of a criticism model in the comments, and people aren't trying to just stir it up. I feel bad for some of my friends who write for traditional media outlets, and you have comments linked up to Facebook, and boy, does that get nasty in a hurry. So, yeah, I prefer our way much better.
People saying you're an idiot, spelling it Y-O-U-R, just littered all over your comment section.
Oh, yeah, that's the least of your worries is grammar, but it does drive me crazy.
Right. No, I mean, my mom, and first off, for my parents, my dad is a subscriber to the website. I saw it on his iPad whenever they were visiting here in Boston. Nice. So Tim McAloon, senior, is a member, a proud member. I don't know if he's lunatic level or what level he's at, but I know he is a paid member of the DK Army.
Well, he's one of what we're up over 22,000 now, so the site has succeeded beyond our wildest dreams. I know when I joined up a year ago, DK said, yeah, we're aiming for, you know, what do you say, 15K or 10K by the end of the year, and here we are a year later at 22,000. So yeah, a lot of the credit goes to the Pittsburgh sports teams, to the fan base around the country, around the world, too. You know how that goes. There are Pittsburgh fans everywhere, so... that's a factor, but we had the Steelers make a playoff run. We've had the Penguins stay in the playoffs for 2 months. That helps subscriptions. The Pirates were great last year, and we'll see how this year turns out, but they're at least interesting. So you have all of that. You add in the colleges, which we're covering full-time now, too. So In a way, it doesn't surprise me how well that it's done. I think people were looking for a different model, a different way of doing it, and they have bought into the subscription model. You know, media made a mistake a long time ago, newspapers especially, by giving away this content for free.
Right.
And that broke the model in a lot of ways, and it's led to many layoffs and papers shuttering. We saw one in Tampa just recently close up shop. So it's a troubling thing in a lot of ways, but there are also ways around it, and I think if you provide quality content, people are willing to pay for it. So that's one thing that has at least renewed my faith in this business is working for this site.
Nice. All right, two quick questions I'll get you out on. Two quick yes or no questions here. One, yes or no, Pittsburgh has a real good chance at pulling the sweep in the three sports that they play in.
It's going to be tough. I wouldn't say real good chance. I'd say they have a decent shot at it with the Steelers, of course. And it's just the Pirates... they're going to be most likely a wild card team, so it's going to be a flip of the coin right away, and that cuts out 50% of your probability right there. It's tough, and with the division they're in, and just the sport they're in, I get the sense that baseball a lot of times can come down to, you know, you talk about luck in hockey, but for the most part, you look at some of the long-term shot numbers and all that, the better teams in possession win it, and the Penguins are one of those, and they're still around. So baseball can come down to which pitching staff heats up. We saw that with the Mets last year and other teams in the past, and I don't think the Pirates have that pitching, that game-breaking pitching, game-changing pitching at the moment. So they're going to have that lineup carry them. So they're going to be the one team that has the lowest shot of winning. But all you have to do is get in. That's what Neil Huntington always talks about.
Great. So 66% chance of a sweep happening. I'll take those odds. So second one from here. Yes or no, your name gets butchered more than your boss's, DeHans?
I think, oh boy, even though DK has built up such a following, people mangle his name up and over again. So
right.
Again, it's Dejan Kovacevic, and for me it's Matt Gajka. I think at least I have a first name that people are accustomed to seeing, so that might tilt the scales in his favor as far as having more people mess it up. We both have that Eastern Euro feel to it, but Geico is a tough one for people. It's just a bunch of consonants slammed together, but I always say it's like Geico, the insurance, except you just add an A at the end, and that's pretty much how you say it.
Well, I butchered it at the beginning, and I'll probably butcher it here as we get out of here as well. I know DK is always my white whale when it comes to the Moby Dick analogy of having him on this show. So pass along my well wishes to him next time you see him there. And he always has a spot open here on the show. I'll say that much for DK.
I'll let him know, man. And I hope you can catch your white whale and play Captain Ahab at that point.
Well, we could never link up back whenever I first started this in 2011-12 because he was under the Trib thumb. So I thought whenever he escaped and formed his own thing, we might be able to link up. But we've always been missing each other. So maybe sometime soon from that one. But yeah, so we'll get you out of here, Matt. So follow you always on DK on sports. Twitter, anything else we can get you out here on the door for?
Just the Riverhounds thing, too. It's a long season, and I'll be on the call there, so riverhounds.com. If you're in the Pittsburgh area and you haven't come down to Highmark Stadium, it's a cool atmosphere. And if you can't make it out, then check it out on YouTube. Watch some highlights, and you can see at least what you're missing in terms of the beautiful game in Pittsburgh. And the team is struggling right now. I'm not going to lie about it. They have one win in their first 10 matches, so they changed coaches, and I think it's a good time to buy low on the Riverhounds bandwagon. I guess I'll frame it that way in a positive direction.
Was it your video that went viral where the guy pulled a Street Fighter II kick in the back of the player, or was that someone else's?
I was not calling that game. I was in St. Louis, but yeah, that was a tough moment because that was the Riverhounds' leading scorer. He had 6 goals in, I think, 6 matches, and he ends up getting suspended for the year by the league, getting released by the team. So that didn't help. That didn't help at all. And one of those things you can't account for when you're building a team, I suppose.
Yeah, that's you cannot. No. I don't think that fits in someone's scouting report whenever they fill out and send it over to a team of how to break down and play each person. Watch out for the Street Fighter kick in the back of someone's back. Yeah, you can't plan for that. All right, Matt, we'll get you out of here on that note there. And hopefully later on around the trade deadline, we'll have you back on to talk more wacky trades.
Okay, man. Thank you. It was my pleasure.